So the topic today is contradictions of the state in the struggle to improve access and the social determinants of illness. And I hate to tell you, but this is going to be a predominantly theoretical presentation, which I've hardly ever done, especially in a setting like APHA. But I actually am pretty convinced that we need to do some serious theoretical work to try to figure out where to go from here. And so what I'm going to talk about at the next one.
Disclosures. I'm good. Meeting learning objectives?
Yeah. So the objectives are to explain the contradictions of the state under advanced capitalism, to analyze the ways in which corporations have become powerful actors in the political and economic landscapes, and the role the state has played in this development, and then to demonstrate that meaningful conceptualization of the state must inform strategies toward a national health program and other redistributive policies that address inadequate access to services and that change the social determinants of health and early death. I just wanted to acknowledge partial support of a very supportive place, the Center for Health Policy at University of New Mexico. So the theoretical framework is that what is the state and how is it important and how do we relate to it? So I wanted to just emphasize that as I and others have thought this through, and there are actually some fundamental contradictions of the state during this period of history. And these pose major theoretical and strategic challenges in public health and in other fields, I would argue, especially when practitioners aim to improve conditions for the underserved or otherwise oppressed people. Next one. And basically, these contradictions center on two roles of the state that are in inherent contradiction. The first, the state's role of service to the capitalist class versus the state's welfare function of service to the poor and vulnerable. The next please. So in this presentation, and I wanted to also acknowledge the role of my co-worker, Rebecca Hassel-Aguilar, and we've collaborated on a number of studies, largely based in Latin America, that touch on these themes, and some of them we've collaborated on in the book that Kira mentioned, which is called Medicine and Republic and Public Health at the End of Empire, which I'm plugging a little bit, mainly to say that I developed these themes in greater detail, and also the proceeds of the book are going to the military support project that I mentioned earlier today in another session, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. So in this presentation, we mainly, Rebecca and I, analyze these contradictions with the goals of understanding the state more clearly and applying this understanding to the development of political strategy. Next, please. So empirically, we explore the ways in which corporations have become powerful actors in the political and economic landscapes and the role the state has played in this development.
Oops.
So more on theory. So, you know, partly because this is a presentation in the Socialist Caucus, I just wanted to harken back to one of the classical works in socialist theory, by Marx and Engels, which actually was referred to in the Communist Manifesto, but also in a number of other key works by Marx and Engels, which is the state as the executive committee of the bourgeoisie. And what does that mean? It means that when there are problems in terms of the continued prosperity of the capitalist class, the main function of the state is to do what needs to be done to enhance and strengthen the position of the capitalist class. And we've seen this nowhere more clearly than in the Great Recession, where we now have a largely socialist economy. Large sectors of the U.S. economy have been socialized. Some of the major productive industries like the auto industry in large part, of the banking industry. You and I as taxpayers actually own a good deal of those industries. But we haven't noticed the progressive elements of socialism, in that this has been mainly a socialism favoring the corporate class, if you see what I mean. It's an intervention of the state to protect the interests of that class. So this analysis, this approach to trying to figure out the nature of the state actually has been looked into to a fairly large extent, and I just wanted to refer to one other key theorist, Ralph Miliband, who has represented the class divisions in the state in the following way. He argued that the corporate elite and the state elite stand on a par with each other at the same highest level of the social order. They form a partnership where state power is capable of exercising some constraints on the extraordinary freedoms of the corporate elites. So, although Miliband clearly argues that the state does have the major role in protecting the interests of the capitalist class, there's also certain ways in which the state modulates that power. So this is a somewhat different conceptualization of the Marxist approach. In that approach, it clearly views the state as subordinate to the capitalist class. And by the way, more recently, work by William Robinson and others on the transnational capitalist class have made the argument that not only is a national state subordinate to the capitalist class, but in fact, most governmental entities of the world have lost their sovereignty because of the dominant position of what he calls a transnational capitalist class that is no longer based in this particular country, but actually circulates among countries and has control over the countries in that way. So what's important at this point is to emphasize that the state has what Miliband refers to as a unique, indispensable, and preeminent role in the defense of the prevailing order in the conduct of class struggle. Now, I wanted to just move on to the welfare state. Now, the welfare state actually flowed, as I'm sure you have realized and studied, out of the problems of the Great Depression, which was essentially a collapse of the capitalist system with many analogies to the period of history that we're living in now. And John Maynard Keynes, the British economist, developed an analysis that he thought, and many others did as well, would lead the capitalist world out of this tremendous this problem, this collapse. And this involved the development of the role of the state. In Keynesian economics, was at the heart of the New Deal policies in the United States, as well as import substitution, industrialization, or ISI in Latin America, and the welfare state in Europe. State management of the economy remained predominant until the 1970s. And I wanted to just mention, since I got these slides together, you know, there was an announcement of the publication of the Bretton Woods transcripts, which just came out very recently. Basically, an economist at the Treasury Department was looking at in an archives and happened to come across the transcripts. And they're actually, what I've seen of them are extraordinarily interesting, because Keynes actually was the British representative who was more or less in charge of the Bretton Woods negotiations that led to the development of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and other major international financial institutions that we have today. And his role was clearly to expand the role of the state and expand the role of these quasi-state financial institutions to protect the economic system and expand the welfare state, but also with a vision that expansion was a way to protect the capitalist system from further crisis. So, state intervention in the economy. State participation in the economy has posed a political threat to the economic and ruling elites worldwide. And what happened by about 1970 is that the is that the welfare state actually had led to a decline in the wealth and the income of the richest people in the Western world, specifically. Shared national income by the top 1% of income earners fell from 16 to 8% after World War II, remaining at such a low for three decades. And at this point, you may remember that, or have learned that the highest income tax bracket was actually 80% in the United States after World War II. 80%. And now it's about 28%. So this has been a tremendous change in the direction of increasing social inequality. But it started off being against the interests of the very rich. In the 70s, the control of assets by the top 1% of holders of wealth plunged as asset values collapsed. And this is described by David Harvey in his really excellent book on the history of neoliberalism. Now, at that time, there was the beginning of a conscious strategy by the capitalist class to change things around. And this was epitomized in a memo that was developed by Lewis Powell, who was at that time a corporate lawyer and eventually became a Supreme Court justice. In a secret memo that he sent to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in 1971, urging American business to fight back. And this led to he was calling for the achievement of political power through united actions and national organizations to build the ideological apparatus to change people's perceptions about corporations, the law, culture, and the individual, leading to an ideological shift. So it's a very conscious plan that Powell and his colleagues developed at that time. And so what happened is that during the 70s and 80s, what was perceived as the exhaustion of Keynesian economics occurred. That is, the exhaustion of the influential role of the state in economic matters. And this paved the way for the ideological shift that we've seen since that time, with a very strong emphasis on market mechanisms and a diminished role of the state. There was an impact of the work and ideas of economists such as Hayek and Milton Friedman, and this was taken much more seriously under the administrations of Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and subsequently. And this led to actual results. For instance, as Edward Wolfe has pointed out, looking at more recent data, the top 1%, so it already had improved from about 6 to 8% of wealth to 34.6%, improved from the standpoint of the capitalist class of it, of all national wealth in 2007. And 2 years later, after the worst of the financial crisis, this proportion increased to 35.6, while the share of the national wealth held by the bottom 90% fell from 25% to 27%. And this pattern has, of course, continued since then, and that the top 1% as of now own about 40 to 41% of the national wealth. So what does the dismantling of the welfare state mean? Well, it actually is a result of a perceived exhaustion of Keynesian policies as paving the way for the ideological shift. And as Cristina Laurel in Mexico and several others colleagues there have analyzed, what this often involves is a systematic weakening and dismantling of the public sector, deliberate practices that convey the perception of an exhausted public system. For instance, in Mexico, Cristina Laurel has documented how there have been systematic cutbacks in the national health budget and the social security system that then have led to weakening, that then have led to criticisms of the public sector as being the right, as being the appropriate source for the delivery of health services, educational services, retirement benefits, et cetera, and pressures then to privatize. So it's a very conscious attempt to weaken the system, leading to criticism of the system, and then further dismantling and privatization. Now, Naomi Klein, of course, has described this as the hollowing out of the state, that it's a systematic and total dismantling of the state apparatus and human resources to carry out its functions in public health and in other areas. Downsizing, however, has not meant smaller budgets. On the contrary, the budgets have ballooned because the contracts are awarded with little or no competition, largely to the military sector and for the reconstruction of societies that are destroyed by war, that is, the social infrastructure destroyed by war, which she refers to as disaster capitalism. Services tend to lack quality, and accountability proves challenging because contractors engage in multiple subcontracts. And under these circumstances, the costs of services become more expensive, and the bulk of the profit is made by the main contractors that are involved. So the corporate sectors have been the main beneficiary of this power restoration during the last 20 to 25 years. The relationship between U.S.-based global corporations and the U.S. government has been characterized by the perception that the interests of both, that is, of government and corporations, are substantially identical. And the government has acted as a sales representative, aggressively promoting U.S. corporations' interests abroad rather than as a political negotiator. Next, please. We see this in public health a great deal, for instance, in WHO's collaborations with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. This is, and the topic that Rebecca has focused on that I want to allude to briefly is in the mental health field, which is only one of quite a few different examples. WHO and to some extent the World Bank have focused on mental health in the less developed countries, a worthy focus, obviously. But for what reason and from what point of view? Well, this has actually contributed to the expansion of the market for pharmaceutical products and also for health insurance companies, while generally disregarding culturally based ways of healing and patient-healer interaction. WHO, PAHO, and multinational corporations have all advocated the enhanced screening for mental health disorders in primary care and also in the general population. Something that appeared, and I actually felt it for quite a long time, this appeared to be a very progressive, important step to clarify the epidemiology of mental health in the developing countries and in the United States and Europe. Several new policy orientations have emerged which favor increased sales of psychotropic medications throughout the world. So what was actually going on at that time was the identification of a potential market by the pharmaceutical industry, the promotion of screening for mental health disorders in primary care as an avenue for increased pharmaceutical sales as a result of that process. Now, how does this happen in terms of the interrelationships between state, pharmaceutical, and managed care industries? Well, basically, this revolves around the revolving door phenomenon, in that there's a passage back and forth between government and corporations of the same individuals and groups who are involved for certain years in corporate life and then for other years in governmental activities. And this is a key instrument for furthering the growth of corporate power. And it also leads us to reconsider the concepts of class struggle and the role of the state in the maintenance of the dominant class's privilege. I really don't have time today to go into this empirically, but I encourage you to look at one of several websites, which is called opensecrets.org. Which is an attempt by several groups concerned about political accountability to actually trace how this revolving door phenomenon occurs and to what extent. So both of these industries illustrate the revolving door phenomenon. Elected officials and staff members of legislative committees and administrative agencies are able to move between the public sector and much higher paying positions in private regulated industries. For instance, about half of the lobbyists hired by drug companies, the managed care industry, and related interests have previously worked for the federal government. And many of them actually are former U.S. senators and representatives. And just as one example, after the debate about Medicare Part D, which increased our own taxpayer support for pharmaceutical coverage under Medicare. Representative Billy Towson, this is just one of several examples, who was the bill's appointment on Capitol Hill, left Congress to become president of Big Pharma at a salary of more than $2.5 million a year, which is, again, not that high in comparison to other, for instance, managed care organization CEOs, but still very substantial. And there are major examples of how this works with Eli Lilly and G.D. Stroh Pharmaceutical Industries. And I just wanted to point to one other example which shows how pervasive this approach is, that it's involving conflicts of interest, companies' profit, and transfers from the public to the private sector. And the Texas Medication Algorithm Project, which is TMAP, was actually created in 1995 while George W. Bush was governor of Texas. And this actually initiated population-based screening for mental health disorders and treatment with medications for individuals who are identified with such disorders. It included guidelines which promoted the use of newer, more expensive antidepressants and antipsychotic drugs as model medication treatment. And this became then a model for the relationship between the federal government and the pharmaceutical industry. And this is just how this works in regard to an Eli Lilly product, olanzapine, which is Zyprexa, used to treat schizophrenia. This became actually Lilly's top-selling drug, and actually Lilly is facing a major crisis now because its patent has run out. The TMAP actually recommended Zyprexa as a first-line drug in the treatment of psychosis. And Zyprexa led the way in both usage and costs at the VA, became actually the highest-cost medication in the VA. The spending on atypical antipsychotic medications increased 70% in that period up in the late 90s, and also in state Medicaid programs, and these are only a couple of examples. In 2002 in Kentucky, it represented the largest single drug expense. And in 2002 to 2003, New York spent more on Zyprexa than any other medication, including cardiovascular medication, diabetes, et cetera, and suffered the largest Medicaid costs in the U.S., largely as a result of the focus on that single medication. So what is the theoretical progress here? Well, our findings actually, we feel, lend support to David Harvey's theory of neoliberalism as a specific project to restore power to the dominant class, and also to Marx's conception of state power subordinated to capitalist economic power. And why is this important? Well, you know, many of us, me and many of the others in this room and in Physicians for a National Health Program and so forth, spend a lot of our waking energy trying to figure out how to improve policies affecting health access to medications, access to a variety of other services, education, et cetera, et cetera. And all of these efforts involve what I view retrospectively in a self-critical way as a very naive vision of how the state actually works. And so my reason for bringing this up isn't that to claim that we have this all worked out, but rather to raise this as an important issue for people to be thinking about and trying to make a progress in. Because with the weakening of the capitalist economic system, the pressures for state intervention, of course, will increase. And there are issues, will the state intervention continue to favor the capitalist class as it has up to now? To what extent will that go beyond the capitalist class? And for this, a meaningful conceptualization of the state, including its contradictory structural position in support of the capitalist class and in support of what we think of as the welfare state, must inform strategies toward a national health program and other redistributive policies that address inadequate access to services and also that challenge the social determinants of ill health and early death. So why don't I stop there? I appreciate your attention.